listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're on Reality Check Radio. It's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Remember, you can send me a text at 2057. You can email me inbox at realitycheck.radio. I'm going to struggle this morning because my next guest is very, very special to me. I'm a total fanboy, and I've been quoting his book probably incorrectly for over a decade. It's Professor David Healy. He's asked to be called David. He's written many books. He's a man of unbelievable talent and achievement. He's a psychiatrist. I think I've got that right. And he wrote a book that affected me very, very deeply called Farmageddon. Not Farmageddon as an F, but Farmageddon in terms of PH. Farmageddon, the book changed my life. Not in terms of the way I lived, but in the terms of the way I saw the world and big science and big pharma. David, good morning.
Good morning, Rodney. Good to be here.
You are an extraordinary person because you trained in a system and you would have believed in it when you started out. Would that be correct?
Yes, and I think probably most people still do believe in it. And my problem is, though, I've got a little glitch in the system, which is if somebody says to me, that color you're calling black is really white. Somehow, if it looks black to me, I stick to my guns. And that's partly what's happened to me. So.
Was it a slow process by which you realized what was going on?
Not especially. No, it was more luck. I had this odd idea after I trained in medicine, first of all, to do some research. I was interested to try and work out, how does the mind fit into the brain? Okay, and particularly the female mind, you know, which is much more complex than the male mind.
Very
anyway,
complex.
Yeah. So anyway, this meant the research that I did by accident, I end up working on the serotonin reuptake system. And this is before we get the group of drugs called the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the antidepressants like Prozac and Zoloft and all those big name drugs, which we've been hearing about now for 30 years. But because I've been doing some research on them, pharmaceutical companies thought I was one of them, and they got me along to educate doctors. And, you know, we were friends, and they talked behind the scenes how they really felt about these pills, how they could fool doctors quite easily, that doctors don't have a thought in their mind that's not put there by us, the pharmaceutical companies. You know, so it was an insight on how things worked, but it all came about by luck, really, you know, because I just happened to end up working on the serotonin reuptake system. And then these drugs come along and they give me insights that I wouldn't have had otherwise.
So you were able to tell the dangers of these drugs because of your research?
Not from the research done in the lab, but very early on, because I'd done research on the drugs, I gave them to people. Okay, just to see how they worked. And it became very clear that some people became suicidal. And when I asked people in the pharmaceutical industry that I knew, they'd say, yeah, we know that. So that was all very clear. The problem was persuading other doctors, you know, who didn't believe the evidence of their own eyes, that yes, these drugs, I mean, they can be helpful. Don't get me wrong. They're not all bad. They'll suit some people. They won't suit other people. Okay. Perhaps the way to bring this out is because I was working in the lab on the serotonin reuptake system, a man in Sweden called Arvid Carlsson, who won a Nobel Prize later, had been the man who invented the idea of a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Okay. And when you asked him, how did you get the idea? He said, well, it was listening to people. You know, there were the older drugs we had, and people were able to say to me quite clearly, look, some of these older drugs, which most people thought were pretty much all the same, some of the patients could say, look, these ones over here chill me out a little bit in a way that these ones over on the other side don't. And he was able to look at it and say, hey, the ones that chill you out a little bit also work in the serotonin system. So why don't we make a drug that works in the serotonin system and not on the noradrenaline system, which is what the other group of drugs worked on? Okay, and but he was working on the idea that these drugs, like LSD, work on a normal serotonin system. And just like LSD, some people will have a good effect with the drugs and other people will have a really bad effect. So with the SSRIs, you could expect some people to do well and others to do poorly. So if you asked Arvid Carlson, who made these drugs, made the idea, can your drugs cause people to commit suicide? His answer was, yeah, sure, there will be some people who they'll cause to become suicidal. You know, so, but that's not the response mainstream medicine has these days. And there's a clue here, which is because I was doing talks for the pharmaceutical companies, you know, there's one talk that I can remember clearly. I was due to give it in London in 1999. And I was asked, look, would you be happy to be involved in this meeting? We're going to have four or five people talking at the meeting. Will you come along and talk? I said, sure. And then a few days later, I get an email saying, we were hoping to produce some articles out of this meeting. Each of the speakers will actually produce an article and we'll have the proceedings of the symposium. And I said, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then a few days later, I get an email saying, and here's your article. It had been written for me.
Yeah!
Absolutely. Not only that, but what they had was, if I took the articles that I'd written and got a few of my friends who figured they know the kinds of things I say and the way I say them, okay, and lay these articles out and asked them to pick out the one that I didn't write, they wouldn't have picked this one out because it was done so well. It was not just the way, sort of the thoughts I have generally, but the way I speak and references to Healy, et cetera, at the end, no one would have picked this out as not written by me. So part of the problem is most doctors don't realize that most of the medical literature in our very best journals isn't written by the people that it seems to be written by. Their names are on the article, but they didn't write it. It's ghostwritten. And the ghostwriters can take a negative study and make it positive. They can say the drug worked wonderfully well in this trial and there were no problems. When you get the data, the drug didn't work in the trial and there's serious problems. But those articles, because they're in good journals, get built into the guidelines, which dictate, and it's not just mental health drugs, it's the heart drugs you might be on, or the gut drugs, or the bone drugs, or whatever. You know, the guidelines that say how you should be treated when it comes to drugs that are on patent, the guidelines are based on essentially fraud.
It's difficult for a person to believe that it's that corrupt.
It's extraordinary. In the UK, the most famous guidelines are called the NICE guidelines. National Institute for Healthcare Excellence, I think it's called. But anyway, so a few years ago, I wrote to the boss of NICE and said, look, what are we doing here? Your guidelines on these drugs are based on a literature that's not written by the people it seems to be written by and is often quite misleading and things like that. And he was about to retire, so maybe this is why things ended up going the way they did. He said, yeah, I know, but what can we do about it?
Because it's a system.
It's a system, and nobody wants to really blow. Oh, well, the people blow the whistle like me, and they just don't get listened to.
And it's a funny thing, isn't it? Because you couldn't live any other way. Like, you're wired to blow the whistle. You couldn't.
I'm not particularly wired to blow the whistle. If you have a soul to sell, you just want a good price for it, and no one's offered me a good price, so.
Oh, I'm sure you're doing yourself a disservice. What I took from Pharmageddon, and it's over 10 years ago I read it, I'm sure. Beautiful book. Stunning book. Thank you for that. Thank you for your work. But it's, I was a politician for many years.
Oh,
and
gosh.
I know how. I
for
know
which
how,
party?
The ACT Party is a little wee party in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how good intentions very quickly get twisted for greed and for political purpose.
Yep.
And the pharmaceutical industry is driven by greed. And the thing that shocked me about your book was the thalidomide story and how we'd come up with these randomized control trials and how they would be the gold standard for never, ever, ever having a terrible thing like thalidomide happen again. And how the randomized controlled trials are actually done in the short time frame over tens of thousands of people looking for statistical things, finding the one good thing, ignoring any, not even looking for deleterious effects, and to produce with one goal, what you called in your book, they were blockbuster drugs that would achieve, I think, $1 billion a year back then. So cynical. Walk us through the thalidomide story and the limitations of the randomized controlled trial and these doctors who endlessly tell us on our TVs, evidence-based medicine.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think the key thing people need to hang on to is called evidence-based medicine. If I'm treating you and you have a problem on a pill, I need it, you know, it'll be evident. You're the person who's on the pill. You can tell what's actually happening. If you come along to me with a problem and talk about what's happened to you on this pill or whatever, you know, if you have a problem, you're not going to lie. Part of my job is there'll be a few people, a very few people who, you know, are trying to game the system, get disability payments or whatever. But for the most part, if people talk about issues happening on pills to them, they've, you know, they're going to be honest. They want help and they're not going to be lying. And if they were lying, medicine couldn't work. You know, so you got to listen to people. And so the crucial thing you want from a doctor is not expertise in how all the drugs work and things like that. The crucial thing you want from the doctor that you go and see is someone who can actually keep you safe. Like, for instance, say you had a tricky car drive somewhere, dead at night in an icy road, known to be dangerous, kills people. Would you want a person who knows all about what's underneath the bonnet of the car, but you've no idea how good they can drive? Or do you want the best driver you know?
Yes.
And you'd want the best driver you know, because that's the key thing. And the key skill for the best driver in the case of treating you with pills is listening to you and believing you. Now, 30 years ago, before the RCTs came on stream, in a big way, nobody would ever say when they went to their doctor that they're gas lit by the doctor. Now, the whole time, again and again, when I meet people, you know, they tell me, you know, I've had this problem on a drug, a bone drug, a mental health drug, whatever. I've gone along to my doctor and he says I'm crazy. Yeah, the drug couldn't be doing this, you know, and I'm being gaslit. And it's partly because it's not in the label of the drug. He looks at the label of the drug and the drug label doesn't say it can cause this. Or even these days, often, if there's a big warning, doctors view them as may contain nuts labels, you know, they aren't things taken seriously. And part of the problem is when the suicide controversy on SSRIs blew up, the pharmaceutical company said, our randomized controlled trials give you the truth about what drugs do. People like David Healy and other people who say they've seen people become suicidal on these drugs, well, that's just anecdotal.
Mm.
And the problem is a lot of doctors and the people on the pills, you or whoever, you know, Doctors in particular, though, ended up losing confidence in their own judgment, figuring randomized controlled trials, tell us what a drug does. And even if I put Rodney on this pill and he seems to become kind of suicidal, well, maybe he's become suicidal, but it's not caused by the drug. Maybe it's all in his mind or whatever, you know. So that's the problem that we've got now. The problem with RCTs is, as you said, there'll be hundreds of people in there and they'll check one little thing, maybe not all the things that the drug does, and they get an average effect. Now, you're not average and nobody who comes to see me is average. There's no such thing as the average person. I've got to be aware that, you know, some people may gain weight on the drug, others may lose weight, and on average, the company will claim our drug has no effect on weight. You can take it, there'll be no problem one way or the other. But that's not the case. There'll be people whose weight will balloon, there's people whose weight will fall off them. And I've got to be able to recognize that and say, well, it isn't all in my mind that this is happening to the person right in front of me. I had a great example. Early when I was training, before I qualified, I was involved in a pharmacology practical. And the thing we had to do was a bit stupid, really. We had to give a drug called a beta blocker. These slow heart rates, they're used to lower your blood pressure and slow your heart rate. And it's one of the most reliable things in all of medicine. Okay, and they're also used to treat people who are anxious because they slow your heart rate. And this fools the brain into thinking, well, he isn't anxious because his heart rate's not racing, okay? But what cardiologists know is when they stop this drug, for a few days, your heart rate may go an awful lot quicker than when you're on the drug. And they tell you, don't make a mistake and think you're anxious. You're not. This is just a withdrawal effect from the drug, okay? So I had to give a beta blocker to the person who I was partnered with, and we gave the drug to her, and a few minutes later, about 10 or 15 minutes later, she was feeling anxious. So we checked her heart rate, and it had increased. Now, the books all say beta blockers slow your heart rate, but, you know, I'm Irish, and the short code for Ireland is IRL, in real life, okay? What's in the books can be useful, but it's not real. What's happening to the person right in front of you is what's real. And the problem we've got at the moment now is, because of randomized controlled trials, doctors don't look at or listen to or, you know, engage with the person right in front of them.
And the trials, if I remember correctly from your book, are a very limited time period, like 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the company isn't searching for a drug that you take and then you're right. They are looking for a drug that you take forever.
Exactly.
That's terrifying. But so obvious, right? You're in a business.
Yep. Oh, of course. Of course. Yeah. And because the trials are quite short and because the companies don't look terribly hard for the problems. I mean, they'll know the problem before these short trials are done. They've done even shorter ones where they give the drugs to healthy volunteers. And just for a week or two, and they find in the case of the SSRIs, the healthy volunteers became suicidal, became hooked to the drugs in just 2 weeks, had severe problems with their ability to make love or whatever. And what the companies do in the trial is they make sure we don't ask about people becoming suicidal. We don't check what happens when you stop the trial and the drug halts. We're told, as I was told when I was helping run one of these trials, don't ask about sex. And I didn't know why that was, but, they knew this is one of the problems their drug causes, and the way to make sure it doesn't show up in the trials is just don't let the doctor ask about sex, okay? So, but what you get out of these trials is the drug looking not too bad, okay? And it's reasonably short trials, as you said. And, if I was to say to most audiences, medical audiences, pretty sophisticated audience, lay audiences, any audience you care to think of. You know, my job is to give a poison and try and bring good out of the use of a poison. People hiss at me. They don't want to hear this. They say SSRI drugs, the other drugs we use, they aren't poisons. They only do good. And I'd say, well, if I said, I'm going to put you on nicotine, you know, wouldn't you think that's, that can make you less anxious. Wouldn't you think that's a poison? And they say, well, yes, nicotine, but hey. In fact, if you put nicotine and alcohol into the short trials, as you mentioned, the companies do, they don't show as many problems as the SSRIs show, even though the companies have gone out of their way to try and hide the problems. And I can tell you a beautiful story about this if you want. Please. Which is, I had a man a few years ago who had obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, and his job hinged on getting some control over it because it was really interfering with his work and he was worried he was going to lose his job. And I liked him. And the number one treatment for OCD, when you look at the guidelines, is give an SSRI. So I gave him an SSRI. And he came back a few weeks later, didn't seem to be helping. So he put the dose up, came back a few weeks later, didn't seem to be helping. We added other things in and didn't help. And a few weeks later, he comes back to me and says, well, it's clearly better. Okay, and he's a bit nervous about this. He lets me know that he's stopped all of my pills. And, you know, he's feeling better now that he's halted them all. But he's still feeling a little nervous about something else he wants to tell me, which is, you know, I did my research and I decided to take up smoking. And I said, fine, if you're feeling better, I don't mind. That's just fine. And he said, but, you know, as I said, I did my research and I've got a bunch of articles. They've been doing clinical trials on nicotine for OCD. Did you know that? And I didn't. You know, I mean, wow. I know all about these drugs. I mean, people like you do your own research and you teach me things if I'm prepared to listen. Okay, so this guy had done his own research and handed me a bunch of articles. And as luck would have it, the top article had a name on it that I knew. It was Arvid Carlson, who had created the SSRIs, which are used for OCD, but had listened to patients with OCD who took his SSRIs, who said, these things don't suit me. When I start smoking, it does a lot better. And he'd run a trial to test it out and said, yep, SSRIs will suit some people. Nicotine suits others a lot better. And, you know, we think about the hazards of nicotine, but in the short term, there's almost none. Yes, you might die from lung cancer. Yes, you might die from a heart attack. You're not going to die from suicide a week after you take the drug. And SSRIs cause heart problems and diabetes and a whole range of other problems. So there's no guarantee because we haven't done that. I mean, you know, we haven't had them for years and years. We don't know that people aren't going to die prematurely. And in fact, all of the evidence we have is that they may die prematurely.
I was shocked to learn, since reading your book, I haven't taken a drug.
And I've not in the business of telling you to take nothing. It's just
no, but you know what I mean. Need to.
Yeah.
And I am very, very skeptical. So I'm not one to go to the doctor and say, I'm feeling ill, give me something and run out because of your book, which I thank you for immensely. And I also took out of your book not to discount drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I am shocked the extent to which what we call antidepressants are being sprayed around our population by GPs, general practitioners here in New Zealand, just, you know, your family doctor.
Mm-hmm.
My little girl's 13. Kids at school are on antidepressants.
Yep.
I find that extraordinary.
Yep.
But what you're describing is the process that makes that.
Yep.
You've got the trials, the papers ghostwritten, the researchers, they're wanting to produce their 300 peer-reviewed papers, and anything that helps them on that helps their career. The drug companies want their billion-dollar drug. The GP's busy. He's been convinced by the peer-reviewed science that he's doing the right thing. He will assess you in 15 minutes and write a prescription. The chemist knows how to prescribe drugs. Here in New Zealand, the government pays for everything because we care about people. And you walk out the door taking these pills for years, potentially, because you are, quote, depressed, i.e., probably going through puberty. How do you look at that without total horror when you're in the business and you've been expounding this and you've seen it? Like, how do you, you must feel like you're screaming at the world. You're like the guy that worked out that what was killing babies was, you know, a lack of clean sanitation. And you're screaming at people, you've got to do this. You've got to, how do you handle the horror of that?
Yeah, well, it's, first of all, you said two things that, you said one thing that is interesting in this sense. You said the pills are being sprayed around the place.
Now, yeah.
Sure, more and more people are being put on them, but it looks like more and more people are ending up on them principally because they can't get off. Now,
okay.
It's not that we're putting more and more people on them each year, although what you've said about kids being put on them, teenagers and all, that is happening now much more than it was before. So, but the biggest problem is when people go on them, they can't get off. And one of the things that leads to is, a few years ago, I had to see this teenage boy being bullied at school. And he said, look, all his friends are on SSRIs, you know, and they say these things chill you out, and I'd like an SSRI. Okay, and he came in to see me with his mother. And she was a nice woman. He was a nice guy. She was a nice woman. Okay. And I said to him, look, you know, if you're hair, and now he's in his teens, okay? And in your teens these days, if you're male, your hair can begin to thin and people freak out. And there's a drug we can use that can help it called rosacea. You know, it can cause your hair to grow again luxuriantly, okay? And I said to him, if your hair was thinning, and you knew about this drug, but I told you that, look, it can cause you to become suicidal. It can also cause your ability to make love to be wiped out forever, and you will never be able to make love again. Would you take the risk? And he said, no, no, absolutely not. I said, let's say you had a few pimples, a bit of acne, not bad. And, you know, there are things we can do, but there's this really good pill called Accutane. Trouble is, you know, it can cause you to become suicidal, and it can wipe out your ability to make love so that you won't ever be able to make love again. Would you take the risk? And he said, no. And I said, it's a little bit the same with the SSRIs you're asking me about. They can make you suicidal. They can interfere with your ability to make love, wipe it out once you hold the pills so you never make love again in your life. Would you take it? And he said, I see your point and things like that. Okay. As I said, he was there with his mum, who's a very decent woman, and she was listening to all this. And he said he was going to go away. And I said, sure, and we can fix you to come back in a week or two. I knew he wouldn't come back. He would go to a different doctor and get the SSRI. Why? Well, his mother was on one. It's a bit like smoking. If you come from a family where your parents both smoke, chances are you'll smoke, okay? If you come from a family for at least one of your parents is on these drugs, and 15% of the population is now on them, you know, and you ask them, are these drugs okay? They're not going to say they've been an idiot and they should never have gone on this. They're going to say, yeah, they're fine, and they'll help you too. So, you know, we've created a situation where the problem is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and the only people who can solve it at this stage are the pharmaceutical companies, who will decide when they find something new that they can make more money from for nervous problems, they'll start telling us about all the problems with the SSRI group of drugs that they haven't been willing to tell us about up till this. And they don't mind if you're stuck on these drugs and can't get off them. And they've done no research on how to solve the problem about getting you off them, you know. But they're going to move on. You know, they're going to get the next group of people on the new pills from which they make more money.
I went to your webpage last night. And listeners, okay. It's David Healy, alloneword.org, and loved it. Thank you so much for taking the trouble. I went to your blog, and the first story was from New Zealand.
Mm.
And I thought, whoa. And I thought, oh, it must be an old story. And it's dated November the 18th this year. And I had never seen this story. And I read it. And I wanted to share it with you. A coroner's inquest into the deaths of six Northland young people, including Martin Lofen Romagnoli, I don't know how to pronounce his name, has revealed systemic failures. The inquiry is also examining the role of antidepressants, including, have I got this right, David, fluoxetine,
yeah.
And seek solutions for suicide prevention. And then it describes Hamaru Ellis Ari, 16, of Rāmanga, died in 2018, loved dancing, rapping and singing. Summer Mills Metcalf, 14, of Kaipara, 14, died in 2018. She was described as a happy, smiling girl who enjoyed pulling pranks on family members. Arteria Heta, 16, of Moera, died in 2020. She was a standout kapahaka performer with a kind nature. Mahi Riri Moana Marshall, 13, of Kaitaia, died in 2018 after being under the care of Orangi Tamariki. James Batara Murray, 12, of Ruakaka, died in 2018. He loved rugby and was a Northland representative. Martin Lofen Romagnoli, 15, of Kaipara, died in 2018. He was a talented hockey player described as friendly and lovable. And then just to read the first next two paragraphs. When Paula Mills took her 14-year-old daughter Summer to get help for depression, she had no idea the common antidepressant they were given could have deadly risks. 4 weeks after doctors doubled Summer's dosage of fluoxetine, commonly known as Prozac, Mills' world shattered when her daughter took her own life. Six deaths linked by Prozac. I read that and burst into tears.
Mm.
And it was a story that I look at the headlines, right? That should be bouncing around front page, that link, with people knocking down doors. And I had to go to an Irish doctor on the other side of the world to have that brought to my attention. That must break you. It's terrible, is it not?
It's happening all over the place. Teens, as you said, are being put on these drugs in a way that just didn't happen. And the interesting thing there is the clinical trials don't show the drugs work for teenagers, you know, which is, I mean, you know, in the case of adults, the trials are pretty poor and they just about show the drugs work. But in teens, it's very clear the drugs don't work. So, you know, we've got a tricky situation, and it's teens coming along and asking for them. You know, they've been told by the teachers, they've been told by the parents, which puts a lot of pressure on the doctor about how to handle it. And you've talked about a busy GP, but, you know, the best doctors I know are GPs, not psychiatrists. Mm. You know, you don't want to think we'd all be a lot safer if just these drugs were restricted so the GPs couldn't actually prescribe them, which is something you hear. As I say, the very best doctors I know, the best drivers of cars, as it were, you know, the ones who handle all these drugs and are more likely to see what's happening to you than the average psychiatrist. There's a Kiwi doctor I know who's the best doctor I know, who's coined the phrase that general practitioners are generalists. They are. And specialists like me, you know, we use the word specialists. She says, you guys are just partialists. And that's very much the case that, you know, when you're dealing with a whole range of different drugs, you do hang on to the skills about listening to people and things like that, and recognizing that, you know, these drugs can do strange things you didn't expect in a way that a partialist doesn't. You know, when they have things, if you've got a doctor who treats eye problems and you put the person on some drug and they talk about visual problems that the partialist has never heard of before, they start thinking you've got a mental problem that's nothing to do with me. I can just pay no heed to what you're saying. But the generalists will be more likely to think, well, we just put you on this drug. I don't know much about eyes, but maybe the drug has caused the problem this person's now complaining about, you know. Mm. So, but anyway, yeah.
When you and I were kids, no one talked about mental health.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a thing. Now, in many ways, I'm sure if you were depressed, that was rather a bad thing. But it was pretty cool. You go along to my kids' school now, everything's mental health.
Yep.
Everything. I had my little middle daughter, wee bit upset. Oh, better go off to see the counselor. And you suddenly realized, now I might be hypervigilant. And as it turned out, the counselor was wonderful and did a great job for my little daughter when she was, 11. Helped her enormously and helped me be a better dad. So for that, I loved her. But you didn't know whether she's going to get her breasts removed or popped onto an antidepressant, because you can end up on a conveyor belt because we're so hypervigilant. And children who, because I'm experiencing this with my family, children who say, oh, I think I'm gay or trans or depressed, within the school grounds and within the school become special. They can't be bullied. They can't be criticized. And the teachers treat them with kid gloves in a way that the other kids don't get treated. So they're rewarded. And we've made it a big thing. Like, I wouldn't have known at 14 to go to a doctor and say I'm depressed. If you know, it wouldn't have occurred to me. But now kids talk about it. That must be a problem in itself, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, sure. And it's not just the pill side of things. It's, as you say, at the counseling side also. And the problem, mental illness, proper mental illness is pretty rare.
Mm.
We all have problems, but these things largely come from the stress of life. School can be stressful, jobs can be stressful, relationships can be stressful. That's really where most of the problems come from. And the problem with pills and the problem with counseling often is it focuses us too much on ourselves and locates the problems in us rather than saying, you know, you're a teenager, you know, you've got a lot of things to sort out. The world's a crazy place. You've got to work out how to manage this crazy place. That's a tricky problem, you know. But it ain't going to be solved by a counselor, and it ain't going to be solved with a pill, you know.
No.
You need to just recognize that it is a stressful period and you will come through it and be fine.
You haven't just been with your torch discovering these problems and then highlighting them and speaking out on them, you've also been coming up with solutions. Tell me what you see as the solutions.
Well, do you mean risk.org or?
Yes.
Yeah, right. Okay, fine. Well, as I said, best doctor I know in the world is a Kiwi generalist, and she's called Dee Mangan. And she splits her time working between Christchurch and Hamilton over in Canada. And if you want to interview someone really good at some point, you should try and get her. I can give you her email address.
Please.
Listen, this is the smartest woman I know.
How do you spell her surname?
Mangan, M-A-N-G-I-N.
Wow.
She's great. But she and I together came up with the idea of risk.org. It's not just my idea.
Yes.
Okay. She was the one, we both thought it would be good to try and see what would happen if we created this, where people could report the problems they had, and we could let them fill a form which helped them work out, is my drug causing my problem? And the idea then was to take the form to their doctor who had put them on the pill, partly because if you just go along, as we would say in Ireland, with one hand as long as the other, you know, you're going to get nowhere. If you have a form, an expert form, which gives you a score saying it's likely your pill has caused this problem, the doctor's going to have to listen to you, you know, pay more heed to you. Trouble is, most people, to some extent, feel, and they're right to feel, I mean, I didn't believe it when this all began, they're right to feel that a lot of doctors are just going to blow them away. They're going to get irritated and angry. You know, they're not going to be, I mean, they look like nice people. They're not going to be particularly nice people. When you say, what they've been trying to do in good faith, when you say that it's not working out, you know, they're not trained to listen to you. Okay, we were hoping this form would help, but it hasn't. It was Dee then who came up with a better idea, which is nobody wants to talk about problems. Okay, so why don't we try and sell people the idea that, you know, if you're on three drugs or less, they're all going to work better than if you're on 5 or 10 drugs. When you think about each of the drugs that people can be on, we think they each work, but once you get over three, they start interacting with each other and causing problems, so they don't work, okay? If you keep to the guidelines for diabetes and for blood pressure and for hearts and bones, you'll be on 10 different drugs. A guideline for people would say, well, the first thing is don't have anyone on more than three drugs, okay? Which should force the doctor and the patient to relate better. You know, I should be asking you, well, what do you want from this treatment? You know, and that should help guide the two of us. And what ones do you think are causing problems? You know, and that should guide how we move forward. You know, and at the same time, I'm trying to sell you. Well, Dee's idea was we're trying to get over to you. You're going to get more out of three drugs that really suit you than 10 drugs, half of which don't suit you. Okay. So it's not saying these things are all bad. It's more trying to make sure people prefer to be getting something rather than having something taken away, as it were. And, you know, so that was the thing that she created called Taper MD. And
just say that again, David. What was she called it?
Taper MD. We're trying to taper you down from 10 drugs to three drugs, say. And the problem is even that it's an easier sell than going into the doctor and talking about the problem your drug has caused me. But it's still not something that the current culture really wants to hear about. You know, politicians in the UK at the moment, we've got a new minister for health called Wes Streeting. Okay. And Wes has been talking about the National Health Service is falling apart. Okay. That we used to, 50 years ago, all those people in work paying taxes and the health service wasn't, you know, it was a thing we could easily afford. There were no big problems. It was only treating heart attacks and things like that. It wasn't giving antidepressants to teenagers. You know, it was just keeping to heart attacks and strokes, the things that you needed to get cured, to help you get back to work. Okay. Now we've got people on pills for all sorts of risks. You know, you're healthy, you're taking pills. You know, it's a bit like taking nicotine to make you less anxious. You know, sure, to make you less anxious, but it's going to cause problems. And where's the saying? We've got the stage now where the National Health Service is this huge, big burden that's crushing us. We can't afford it, and it's not getting us well, okay? So the pharmaceutical industry listened to Wes and said, you're right, you know, what you need is preventive treatment. We need you to start putting people on pills when they're well so that they don't get a heart attack and stuff. They're very good. But you know, the politicians are just stupid. They can see what the problem is, and they don't realize they're being bought and sold.
Yes.
People are listening to their words and saying, I have the answer to the problem you've got.
I'm very interested in you're saying about how you go along to your doctor and you try and put it in the most gentlest of ways and they get angry. I haven't had the need to go to doctors, but I have exactly the same thing with school teachers. Mm-hmm. Beautiful people, wonderfully kind, smile. And I go along and I know not even to do it, because I go along and I say, look, you know, I'm not an expert or anything, but I'm just a little bit worried about you teaching my 10-year-old that perhaps she could be a boy, right? And they actually shut down and are about to erupt and get angry. And it's like you're talking to someone in a cult, that you're challenging their fundamental beliefs, that you're challenging their operating system that they themselves have never examined and don't have an argument for, so they don't even know how to respond, other than you can see them thinking, oh, yeah. I remember when I was at teachers' college, they said, you're going to come across these old dinosaurs, you know? Just ignore them, they'll die off. Because they actually, it's a cognitive dissonance or something. I'm talking in your expert field, but there's something in the head that just by being so gentle, you're actually rocking their world. Would that be fair comment?
Well, I think it is. Let me add to it a little bit. Yes. I think it's not necessary that the teacher's convinced trans is right and every kid who says, you know, yes, I'm not really a boy, I'm a girl, or vice versa, that they have to be believed. It's, I'll tell you, there's something else that goes on. And what you've picked is a great example for a bigger problem, which I'm going to go on to now in a sec, which is that the teachers know if they don't keep to the party line, it's not necessarily their line, they risk a complaint and they risk losing their job.
Unbelievable. Now,
it's the same in medicine these days. Doctors are told your views are anecdotal. The truth about these drugs is they can't possibly cause you to become suicidal. You come in and you talk about your child has become suicidal and you want to stop this drug that they're on. A lot of them know that if they agree with you, there's going to be complaints and they're going to lose their job. We're operating in an atmosphere of fear. And the trans kind of example that you've just used.
Big example.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But it's not just confined to trans. Within healthcare, that's across the board.
Well, we saw that with COVID.
Yes, we did. Yeah.
Where GPs were, and they have an extraordinary ability. I never know who quite the they are. You always say they. But what we saw, and we've seen it with trans, because we follow the news in the UK, where you'll have school teachers and you'll have doctors who step out of line and they are destroyed, J.K. Rowling. They are destroyed and attacked, and their heads are placed on a pike outside the city gate for
everyone to see. To everybody else, yep.
Sure. And you think, if they can attack J.K. Rowling like that, if they can attack that professor of medicine like that, I have no chance. I've got a mortgage, and I keep my head down.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to rock the boat. And no one got into trouble by following the guidelines and the rules.
Exactly. Yep.
I've got my insurance that covers me. I'm just doing what I'm told. And it's totally understandable. Do you think RFK Jr., we all hope, I think, can he make a difference?
Well, first of all, he has to get appointed.
Yes.
We have to wait and see, yeah. And he's saying a lot of very useful things, and there's a lot of misinterpretation about the things he says. It's twisted in all sorts of ways to make him look bad. But, you know, he has been saying a lot of very sensible things for a long time. And I have to say, I'm one of the people who figures it would be great for the system if he does get appointed and has a chance to shake things up. Now, not destroy everything, but there's a lot that needs shaking up. It's gone badly wrong. The New England Journal of Medicine, supposedly the best journal in the world, well, it's full of articles that just aren't. English. Well, yes. Exactly.
We don't want the French Revolution and the tyranny coming out of that. We want this resetting where I loved your phrase, evident medicine, and scientific skepticism, and care, and listening. But you're watching this play out with him, and there is multiple billions of dollars at stake. People don't give up $1 billion readily.
No.
And potentially careers being wrecked for the fraud, and potentially court cases and fines and prison. So there's a huge amount on all of this. And so you're watching this at a distance. And for our part, we have fingers crossed praying for him, because he's like David against Goliath, like you are David against Goliath. But he's got potentially, if he gets through the process, power to open it up, start a proper discussion, and lead the world back into a better place for healthcare and drugs and a whole lot of other things that flow from that. But it's a big system.
Well, it's interesting in the sense of there's a few bits to the system. There's the pharmaceutical companies. Now, they can make anything work. They can work with him and get probably just as much money out of working with him as they're getting from at the system as it is at the moment. The people who are going to lose out, in a sense, it's no harm if they lose out. If it causes them to wake up and smell the coffee, it'd be good. The people who may lose out the most are doctors. And I've been saying, you asked me how do I put up with all the things going on. The only thing that registers with doctors in talks that I've been giving, and it goes back 20 years when I actually began to say this first, you know, if the drugs work so well and are free of problems in the way we're being told, doctors are out of a job. The people who run health service companies are going to figure, well, physicians associates, nurse prescribers are all going to be cheaper prescribers. You know, the drugs work, they're free of problems, so we don't need expensive prescribers like doctors. So if you look at the people who are complaining most about RFK and how crazy it is at the moment, it's not the pharmaceutical companies, it's doctors, it's medical journals saying, this man is crazy, we don't like what he's doing. Well, you know, they're the ones who haven't stood up and said the kinds of things that he's saying. I mean, there's a lot of what he's saying that makes perfect sense, but you haven't heard doctors say it.
No.
And they should have been saying it, you know, if they want to hang on to their job, if they want to say, you know, I need a well-paid job because, you know, it's terribly tense and nerve-wracking giving these dangerous pills, you know, they've lost the plot and he is the Grim Reaper coming to sort them out, I think, you know.
So. And as you say, these companies have great abilities to pivot into a new area of...
and make the new way of doing things work for them just as well as the old one.
Plan B and a plan C and a plan D, and they will do okay. And it's the core teeth in the cogs of the machine that get ground.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. What would be your advice to listeners who are aware of this, who are skeptical, but distrusting, but we need to see doctors? We need our medicine. We may need psychiatric drugs. How do we pick our way into the system, given it may not be our position just to be all high and mighty and say, I'm never going to go near it? How do we manage? Because we can't all find wonderful doctors like you or your friend, D. Mangan. We can't find these people in our communities. What's your recommendation to us?
Yep. Well, I think the key thing is you've got to try and find a doctor you can trust and can work with. It really, at the heart of the issue, medicine has to be relationship-based, not evidence-based. Evidence-based, this is dealing with the English, as we Irish have to do, and you guys have to do with the Australians, I guess. It's, you know, evidence-based medicine sounds good, but it's really about trying to persuade you not to believe the evidence of your own eyes.
Mm.
You know, this is why evidence-based medicine is more important. And you'll there's a lot of good generalists out there. And most doctors, you know, as you've explained, they're rushed and things like that. And so they can make mistakes, but most of them mean relatively well. So the trick is recognizing that, you know, it's got to be relationship-based. You try and find a doctor who you feel listens to you and looks at you. And a really good doctor won't be doing it on a video screen. They'll want you in the room, okay? Because they may detect a change in your smell, for instance, and this may be important. You want to feel from a good doctor that you're in the room with them and them only, that there's not a bunch of other people. You don't feel the guideline people in there. You don't feel the hospital managers in there. It's just you and the doctor. Now, the other thing is to, you know, there has to be a little bit of art on our side as well.
Of which course, is, it's a relationship, you know, it's both ways.
Yeah, yeah. We've got to learn to how to seduce them, as it were, you know, to make them feel good.
We need that Irish charm.
Well, to help make them feel good, to help them think they came up with this good idea when in fact you've been planting it for them, you know. So, yeah, this, I mean, as you say, it's crucial that we will need a good doctor at critical points. I mean, there's an awful lot of stuff we go along to doctors for that you don't need to be going to them for. And, you know, the risk is that in good faith, they'll give you stuff which makes things worse. So, you know, you want to take care and not go there too quickly. But yeah, we do need good doctors. And there are a bunch of good doctors out there who will work with us. And they're more likely to be generalists than specialists are. Good generalists will know the good specialists, the ones you can be safe with, as opposed to the ones you probably can't be safe with. So, you know.
And how do you handle the aged and the infirm? Because with my mum, always healthy, but her last 2 years were off to the doctor on a weekly basis, a great array of drugs, confusing as all get out, drugs affecting her. She had never been a person who could even swallow a tablet. She'd have to have yogurt with it and try and get these poor tablets down. She had this great array of tablets that she's explaining, and it became her life, you know, with old people, how it does.
Yeah.
And she and I both agreed that it was amazing, astonishing, like ridiculously so. But we didn't know what else to do.
Mm-hmm.
If you know what I mean, because it was like, if you get old and they start giving you all these pills and they say, well, look, this is a new one. Try this. You've got some bad effects. Yeah. So we'll try this. And maybe that great line should have been, doctor, I'm going to take three and only three. So let's work out the best three for me. I'm in my 90s. Three drugs is enough for me. That would have been a good thing for her, right?
Yeah. There's one or two other things. First of all, you need to interview Dee. She's the expert on just the problem you're talking about. Okay. But the other thing is, I guess it comes to the days when we used to go to doctors all that often. We only went to them when we had a serious problem that we needed help with. Okay. Yes. Now they come to us, they reach out to screen us for this, that, and the other. Okay. One of the key things when you go into a doctor, and particularly if you're older, is, doctor, there's something you need to know about me. And it's not what's wrong with me or what I want fixed. It's what I want from life. You know, my strong points and how you can help me ensure that these stay intact, which may not mean treating me. It may mean telling me to change my diet or get fit or whatever, you know, maybe socialize more. But if you go in and talk about a problem, pills somehow become the answer to the problem. What you want to get over to the doctor is your goals. Thanks. You know, I've got a family. I love looking after my grandchildren or whatever. You know, these are the things that I need help to make sure I can continue doing them. You know, and I don't want a pill that's getting in the way, which means I can't go out for a walk with them. You know, if you think the pills you're going to put me on are going to get in the way of the things that I really like doing, you need to let me know this and I can work out if I really want to take them or not.
David Healy, Professor, what a wonderful tour de force.
Rodney, it's been great talking to you.
Well, Professor David Healy, if you look at his CV, it's like up there with the greatest. It's the best. But he's talking to us as another human being, talking about relationships and shining a light on the difficulties of the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry and how we can pick our way through it. He's a charming man, being Irish, and I've got to tell you, I guarantee he's never been told this, but he reminds me, as I look at him, of Liam Neeson. Is he Irish?
He is, yes.
You look just like him. It's amazing.
I'm not sure, but yeah, he is Irish, definitely.
There you go. You're so extremely charming. Do you live in Ireland?
I live in the UK at the moment, but I spend quite a bit of time in Ireland. And if I can get to New Zealand, I get to New Zealand.
Have you been here before?
I have, yes.
Oh, how wonderful.
Mm.
Oh, wow. You will have
some of the best doctors, some of the best people I know live in New Zealand.
Yes. Well, you're most welcome to come and visit. I live in one of the primo tourist destinations of New Zealand near Queenstown.
Oh, and right. So, well, I've been to Queenstown. Yes.
There you go.
Yeah.
So you must, when you visit next time, you must come down and you will have a huge fan base here because of your presentation on our station. But I can also recommend everyone to read your books. Pharmageddon, like I said, was I have dined out on it because I tell people about if they ran nicotine or alcohol through a randomized controlled trial, it would become a billion-dollar blockbuster drug.
If you want to read, if people want to read a book that's more about these drugs and the drugs being given to children, there's a book called Children of the Cure, which is shorter and is a detective story in a sense, right? It's less abstract. Yeah, yeah.
I'll get that.
Children of the Cure.
Thank you so much for your work. Thank you so much for being generous with your time. For people that want to text us with questions, 2057, or email me, inbox@reallycheck.radio. And David is going to send me, through Bex, the contact details for that wonderful New Zealander, Dee Mangan. And if she's willing, we're going to have another tour de force.
Excellent. She'll be even better than me.
Whoa, I can't believe that. We're truly blessed with our guests, truly blessed with our listeners. Thank you so much for tuning in.
From caps to tees and from bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.